This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. It is time to go around the world, and for the first time since the war began 121 days ago, we're going to go to Moscow. Diana Magnay is the Sky correspondent in Moscow. And Diana, a very good morning to you. Welcome to Overnights.
Thank you. Nice to be on it.
What's life like in Moscow these days? When a war is going on in Ukraine next door, what's day-to-day life like in Moscow?
Well, the amazing thing is that it all looks and feels pretty much the same. The sanctions haven't really started to show themselves yet. I think they're an instrument that takes a long time to sort of play out. And so in day-to-day life, you're not really seeing and feeling it. And people have essentially, to the larger extent, fallen behind the war effort. Whereas in the first few weeks, you had pretty muted anti-war protests. Those were crushed so quickly. And now if people are complaining about it or worried about it, they've either left the country, and in the first few weeks, hundreds of thousands of Russians did, or they know that they can't really talk about it, and they'll be talking about it in their kitchens as they did in Soviet times. But out on the streets, people are still going around doing their daily business. The shelves are still pretty full. And I think in terms of the sort of impact on supply chains, you know, they're still using stocks and inventory. So you don't feel like we're not getting the goods in that we need. That may be a different story for the Russian military, where a lot of components aren't coming in. It's definitely true for the car industry, where, you know, the pressure is beginning to build. But as far as day-to-day life goes, it looks pretty much the same as it did.
Are there any restrictions on what you can report? Because one of the things we've heard about this war is that the Russians are not being told the truth about what's going on and how badly it's going for the Russians. What can you report on? Are there any restrictions?
Massive restrictions. I mean, essentially, we're under military censorship. We're not allowed to call this a war. It's known as a special military operation, even though every person you speak to on the street calls it a war. And you're not allowed to report anything that doesn't come from official sources. So how the war is going is all dependent on what the Ministry of Defense says about how the war is going. But fundamentally, and this is now 4 months into the war, you know, the assessment that we as a foreign journalist community are sort of slowly coming to is that these restrictions mostly apply to Russian journalists broadcasting in Russian to a Russian audience, because it's the Russian people that Vladimir Putin does not want to know what's really going on. And we hope that it doesn't necessarily apply in quite the same way to the rest of us, but we do have to be fairly cautious. Yeah.
So are foreign reporters safer then, do you think, than Russian reporters?
I think historically that's always been the case. This is a totally new situation. But I do think that for whatever reason, the Russian government still wants some foreign journalists here. But it is always the Russian independent journalists who've been the first to come under attack. They are the ones who face escalating criminal charges. They are the ones who are called foreign agents. They are all the independent ones now largely operating from outside the country, because it is much more dangerous for them, and it has been for a much longer time. And it's, you know, Russian journalists from Novaya Gazeta, the editor of which won the Nobel Peace Prize this year, you know, six of their number have been killed over the last two decades. It's not so much foreign journalists in Russia who come under in for problems, it is the Russians.
So how is the fact that Ukraine will join the EU, how is that being reported in Russia, or is it not being reported at all?
No, it's being reported, but it's being reported pretty straight. What they're saying is that it will take some time. This is largely a symbolic move. And Vladimir Putin has already said, and this was repeated by Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, today, the EU is not NATO. To us, it doesn't matter if Ukraine and Moldova are given candidacy status. That's, you know, that is, it's not a military political bloc. That's not our major bugbear. So I think they're being fairly straight about this. They're picking their battles, and this EU candidacy is not one of them.
So does it make any difference then, if that's the case, that Ukraine is in the EU? I think it's probably fair to say they wouldn't have made it into the EU, certainly not this quickly, had it not been for the war. Does it make any difference to Ukraine, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's hugely significant symbolically for Ukraine, but it is only candidacy status, and they are now part of a list of various countries who are on the candidate status for EU. They have to undergo various reforms. It's all going to take quite a long time. But if you think about the fact that in 2013, 2014, when I stood on the Maidan reporting from there about the fact that students essentially and Ukrainians were going out to demonstrate about the fact that their leader then was pulling away from this European Association agreement under pressure from Russia. That wasn't anywhere near what they've been promised now. And yet in the interim, we've had so many deaths, such a large war. You know, at what cost does this candidacy status come? And also, if you think about it, you know, Georgia and Ukraine were promised NATO membership, that they would one day accede to NATO back in 2008 in Bucharest. And that didn't really go anywhere. So I think we're still looking far ahead in terms of Ukraine joining the EU. But of course, they're pleased about it. Yeah. But it's come at a massive cost.
Yes, Diana Magne is our guest in Moscow. So are you able to go to Ukraine and then come back to Russia? Or do they ban you from doing that?
I haven't, because we've been keen to maintain our Moscow bureau, and I have many colleagues who are reporting from Ukraine. Some of my colleagues from other networks have gone to Ukraine, reported from there, and a few of them have come back in, but a lot of them have chosen to stay away. And certainly when this law against free reporting, essentially, around the war was introduced shortly after the beginning, a lot of the print journalists left and have not come back. So it's still a really unclear situation.
Now, you mentioned about how the sanctions haven't really bitten yet, but we've got another major company announcing that it's leaving Russia. That's Nike. Will that have any effect at all?
Well, it comes on the heels of Renault and McDonald's all saying that they were going to pull out. A lot of the companies at the beginning put their staff on furlough and said that we'll keep paying them, and decided to assess what would happen. And I think more and more will pull out, especially as the government talks about essentially passing the ownership of these companies into Russian hands. Morally, it's a very difficult position to take, to still be based in Russia. But you walk through the malls, and although a lot of shops are boarded up, there are still quite a lot of international shops still open, especially French and Italian, I've noticed. So, you know, some businesses have shut up shop, but not all have.
Mm. What about things like the World Cup or Eurovision, the fact that Russia was not allowed to take part in them? Does that have an effect at all? Is that being talked about?
I think that Russia has this line, certainly the foreign ministry talks about it a lot, of cancel culture. It seems to be one of their favourite phrases at the moment. So they keep saying, everybody forgets what comes before and why we went into Ukraine. They're saying that Russia's being cancelled across the world stage. I think, you know, that's part of their narrative about not being allowed to, for example, Russian players to play at Wimbledon. So that accentuates for their own people this idea that the Russian people should rally around each other. This is an attack by the West. Whilst at the same time, Vladimir Putin is pushing this notion that it's a multipolar world. He's sitting there at the BRICS summit at the moment, BRICS Plus, talking to all these other countries who actually don't necessarily follow the West in their assessment that this situation in Ukraine is egregious and existential, who actually, whoever was right or wrong in terms of going in the first place, are kind of on Russia's side in the idea that they're gaining leverage against the West in all of this.
Yeah. So what about Vladimir Putin's health? There's always rumours about the health of any Russian leader going back to the communist years. What about now? There's all sorts of stories being told that, you know, he is very unwell, and this is one of the reasons why the war happened. What are you hearing about his health?
To a certain extent, I just discount those. I think there's a lot of wishful thinking bound up in these rumours about his health. There have always been reports that Vladimir Putin is suffering from this or that. I watch him a lot. in all of these briefings that he gives. He looks pretty healthy to me. Even if he is on steroids, which some people say, I don't think that will have affected his decision to start this war. I do think that we're kind of clutching at straws here.
Right.
He doesn't look like a man who's had more than a few fillers in his face, really.
All right. How visible is he? Is he out there every day or every week? Does he talk to the Russian people often?
He certainly doesn't come out and talk to the Russian people. And you'll remember in all the diplomacy that preceded February the 24th, there was the kind of joke about the fact that he wouldn't meet world leaders except at the end of a very long table. And most of his meetings are still done virtually, but he does do a lot of those meetings. And he's met the leader of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, in person quite a bit. He is sitting at the BRICS summit virtually. He has quite a lot of virtual meetings with his Security Council, two or three a week now, which are televised. So he's out and about, definitely.
Mm. One of the things that did happen, though, this week was that Russia issued a list of people it was banning from visiting the country or ever coming to the country, journalists, politicians, celebrities. It became a bit of a badge of honour to be on that list. And I know in Australia, where we had quite a few people on that list, some people were really annoyed that they were not on the list.
Well, I think it's certainly in terms of the list that was issued for the Anglo-Saxon media, which is the way that they like to characterise the Brits. It was a lot of people, first of all, who've been in Ukraine and covering the war from there. And secondly, for example, the director general of the BBC or the editors of major newspapers who may have come to Russia in the past, but certainly haven't been regularly going to and fro in the past few months. In terms of people who actually make it their daily business to come in and out of Russia, there was nobody on that list who was really impacted in terms of what they do. So I still think it was pretty token. It was a way of saying we are taking measures, but against people who are doing their work outside of Russia and probably wouldn't have come in any case at the moment.
What do you think might happen if there is not an appetite for this military incursion, this war, that if it really does turn bad for the Russians? At the moment, it's kind of gone off the front pages. It's still there, but you have to, you know, get a few pages into the newspaper or a little way into the news bulletin before you find out what is happening, compared with what happened originally when the war began, when it was the front page, when it was the first item. You know, what's going to happen? How long can this go on, and how long do the Russian people have an appetite for it?
So I don't think it's gone off the front pages in Russia, and it is still a primary topic, even if they do couch it as a special military operation. And as far as actually the status of the war at the moment, Russia, the Ukrainians today said that they had to retreat from a major city in the Luhansk region in eastern Donbass, Severodonetsk, and that they were pulling back from there. And essentially what we're seeing in this second phase of the war is a long drawn out war of attrition where both sides are suffering serious casualties, and there is no doubt that they are. But even the Ukrainians have admitted that they are outgunned and outmanned, which is why they're desperate for more ammunition and more weapons from the EU and from the US. And I think Russia is in this for the long haul. And I think Vladimir Putin's bet is that the attention of the West will fade away from all of this, that economic problems in the West, that inflation, that the pressure he is exerting on the EU through gas and energy prices will be enough to make them lose attention. And you know, if we saw the Russian army, the Russian military in the first phase of this war, when they made this very misguided mad dash for Kyiv, which clearly didn't work, and now they have retrenched into a war of attrition where they're essentially trying to gain territory in Donbass, they seem to be making slow, very slow, some progress against the Ukrainians. And I don't think Vladimir Putin intends to give up on that anytime soon. Mm-hmm. And remember, the Russian public don't have any real idea of what's going on. They're being told that any war, even if it's not called that, will casualties will be sustained. But the last time that we had any real numbers on casualties officially was in March. So they may be extremely high, but that's not really filtering down to the Russian mothers at the moment. And to a large extent, also, a lot of those mothers of boys, young men who are fighting against Ukraine at the moment, would prefer to think that their sons died in pursuit of a noble goal than for an utterly pointless cause. So again, this hope that when they see actually the real cost of all of this, opinion will change. I'm not sure. The sanctions and the fact that it's being pitched by the Kremlin as Russia against the West have really just served to sort of consolidate the Russian people at the moment rather than to turn them against the Kremlin. And given the sort of repressions that we've seen over the past few years that have just upped in pace, people know that it's incredibly difficult to stand up, draw attention to the Kremlin's false narratives.
Does anything light or funny or amusing happen in Russia?
Yes, it does. There's comedy, but they can't touch on political issues. You know, the sun is shining, the hipsters are going out to their bars. It still looks the same. You know, people are going out to the parks and they're swimming in the rivers and they're paddleboarding and they're all having a good time. That's the terrible thing when you think about this kind of moral absence at the core of the leadership.
I suppose they're going to take their opportunities while they can when the weather is a little bit warmer than it might usually be in Russia. Diana Magnay for Sky in Moscow. Thank you so much for talking to us.
It's a pleasure.
Overnights with Rod Quinn
on ABC Radio.